Thank you, Nigel, for that warm, amusing, and historical introduction. The nice aspect about the history is, one, he didn't tell you all the stories he could have about our times in Churchill. Thank you, Nigel. And two, my talk also has a significant historical component, and I hope that will become clear, and so it's a wonderful segue into the talk. So as Nigel said, I'm going to tell you about the odyssey from the Fermi-Pasta-Ulam problem. Don't worry if you haven't heard about it. I'll define it in brutal detail, to something called intrinsic localized modes, which is one of the newest areas of interest in nonlinear science. And this is sort of a nice image. This image has acquired probably a less good, hold this down a little bit, a less good feeling than it had in the past, because it is sort of a harbor wave or a tsunami, which now has negative connotations that it didn't have a few years ago. Anyway, I'll tell you what I'm going to tell you. I want to start out by, because I have a tendency to run long in my talks, I want to make sure that I get to the bottom line, so I'm going to start with it. I will tell you what these intrinsic localized modes are and why they're important. Please don't go to sleep after that, because the rest of the stuff's going to be on the quiz, too. And then I'm going to go back to the beginning, the Fermi-Pasta-Ulam problem, and explain how this very interesting study led to the discovery of solitons and the concept of a completely integrable, infinite-dimensional Hamiltonian system. I will, again, define that as we go along. And then show how the questions of what was happening in these continuum theories, in fact, reflected on the existence of a particular kind of excitation called a breather, not in the continuum, but in a discrete model. And then I will show that these discrete breathers are actually the same as the intrinsic localized modes, and show you how you can discover them easily in something which I will call the anti-continuum limit. And I'll leave you to puzzle what that might be for the moment, and hopefully I'll be able to explain it. The intuition behind these things is surprisingly simple. It's one of these problems where once you realize the right way to look at it, you think, why didn't I think of it before? And I'll try to leave you with that intuition so if you won't forget it in the future. There were, as Nigel indicated in Chaos, there were many historical precursors of these intrinsic localized modes. This time, I think, actually, the chemists in the 20s get the credit for nearly discovering it. But there were also precursors in both the work I described above and in Landau's Polaron. This is probably the essence of the talk, some current experimental observations of ILMs. These are not just theoretical constructs. They're real-world phenomena and have been implicated in a lot of interesting physical processes. And I will end with some comments on where they might go in the future and summarize and conclude. I have the bulk of this article is based on a Physics Today article I wrote with Yuri Kivshar and Sergei Flach about 2 years ago now, and I have a few copies of that here if people want it, and I have more at home if we run out. Anyway, that's a lot to cover, and since Nigel has taken a full 10 minutes of my time, I will allow myself an extra hour and a half. And as you can imagine, I had a talk on the Fermi-Pasta-Ulam problem and a talk on the ILM, each of which was an hour, and I combined them, I superposed them to make this talk. So we'll see. Please do interrupt with questions, because, in fact, I might even stop and force you to ask questions, because I want to keep you engaged. So this is the bottom line, as I promised. This is the definition of what I will call intrinsic localized mode or discrete breather. Those terms actually arose from different historical trends, which you should be able to figure out when I explain the historical precursors. But from my point of view, they're absolutely equivalent. What do I mean by that? An intrinsic localized mode or a discrete breather is a very highly localized spatial mode, time periodic, stable, or at least very long-lived, in a spatially extended, perfectly periodic discrete system. So think of a chain of atoms, either classical or quantum, but we'll start with the classical case, discrete entities coupled together by springs, if you want. You think of establishing one or two or three of these atoms moving very highly excited, highly nonlinear, and it stays periodic and localized, does not propagate out, stays localized. That's at this stage, it should be surprising, given everything you know about coupling and springs and solid-state systems, and theorems about block waves in perfectly periodic lattices. We'll come back and try to explain the intuition at the end. And the bottom line is, Although the theoretical mechanism that describes these excitations, that permits their existence, has been understood for now it's almost 15 years, the pioneering works of the authors are there, only recently have they been observed in physical systems, a large number ranging from solids through Josephson junctions, very interesting work in photonic structures, and even some micromechanical oscillator arrays. I probably shouldn't say this, but this article is a good example of where procrastination is useful. We started writing it, and it was supposed to come out sometimes in 2002 or 2003, and of course, we didn't get it done. Between the time we had finished the bulk of the article and the time that we actually had to submit it, three or four important new experiments came out confirming the existence of these things. So we were very lucky. We could take the latest data and put it right in. I don't recommend that to the graduate students. Don't try that with your thesis, but we got lucky this time. So let's go back to the beginning and the Fermi-Pasta-Ulam problem. This is a wonderful story. At Los Alamos, it was in called Los Alamos Scientific Laboratory. In the summers of 53 and 54, Enrico Fermi, John Pasta, and Stan Ulam decided to use the world's most powerful computer, which was called the MANIAC 1. It was based on a computer that von Neumann had built in Princeton for mathematical analyzer, numerical integrator, and computer. Nick Metropoulos is responsible for that name. And what they wanted to study was the question of the equipartition of energy that you expect from the arguments of statistical mechanics in a very simple classical model of a solid. Fermi had long been interested in statistical mechanics, and so he said, we're going to start with these nonlinear problems. We're going to study the simplest one, a 1D model, a chain of equal mass particles coupled by nonlinear springs. So here's the reason he said they had to be nonlinear is they all knew that if you have linear springs, by Fourier analyzing everything, you can separate the modes, and you obviously will never get equal partition because the modes don't couple. So here's a picture of the model. Here are the masses from 1 to n, or 0 in this case, coupled by springs. The springs have a potential which is nonlinear. So here is the standard Hooke's law, which would lead to a linear force. This is the linear part, the potential being quadratic. The equation of motion is linear. There was a cubic nonlinearity and a quartic nonlinearity. And the coefficients are designed because this model by itself was called the FPU alpha model, and that model by itself was called the FPU beta model. I won't go into the detailed distinctions about the differences between the models because they both produce more or less the same results, but there are some interesting subtleties. So this is a cover page. Notice some interesting stuff here for reference only, not to be taken from this room, you know, all that sort of stuff. I actually was given the last circulating copy of this preprint. This is the FPU preprint. Lots of interesting things here. Studies of nonlinear problems 1. This is intended to be the first of many studies. Published in 55. The work was done by these four individuals, but this individual, Merit Singhu, who will come back later, was the one who actually wrote the code, and these are the people who wrote the paper. Another lesson for graduate students, if you write the code, get your name on the paper. So this was the abstract. I don't know how much the people in the back can read this. It refers to the fact that Fermi passed away in November of 54, and that's why there was only studies in nonlinear problems 1 and not continued. But the key conclusion, this is a description of what they actually did. They studied this chain with the MANIAC 1, and they said the results show very little, if any, tendency toward equal partition of energy among the degrees of freedom. So what FPU discovered was they set out this system where they thought they excite the system in some mode, it should spread out by stat-mech, so the energy was spread among the various modes, and they did not see that. Now, how strikingly, I'm going to go on a little bit more about this. I promise I won't go through the whole preprint. All t equals zero. Hamiltonian simulation of a classical mechanical system. No temperature. So this is I don't want to go through the details of this, but I want to show you this thing. So Fermi and Pasta and Ulam realized that for complicated nonlinear problems where you didn't have an analytic handle initially, you'd have to treat them essentially experimentally. So von Neumann, a few years earlier, had actually called this experimental mathematics. And they're referring to specifically an experiment in mathematics. And here's what von Neumann said. Our present analytic methods seem unsuitable for the solution of important problems arising in connection with nonlinear partial differential equations and in fact with virtually all types of problems in pure mathematics. Really efficient high-speed computing devices may, in the field of nonlinear partial differential equations, as well as many other fields which are now difficult or entirely denied of access, provide us with those heuristic hints which are needed in all parts of mathematics for genuine progress. So that is about as ringing an endorsement of what we now call computational science as you could possibly get. That was written in 48 by von Neumann. This study is 54. This is one of the very first where computers were used to study a fundamental question in science and physics that had not been accessible beforehand. And here you notice that at least Mary Tsingu got an acknowledgement, even though she didn't get an authorship. So what did they actually discover? First, they discovered that starting from their initial conditions, and we can talk about whether their initial conditions were generic enough, only the lowest few Fourier modes were excited. So you have 64 particles in the chain, and you have, therefore, 64 Fourier modes, modulo boundary conditions. Only the lowest few were excited. So what you see here, this is directly from the paper. I hope it's pretty visible. These are time in thousands of cycles, where the cycle is the fundamental period of the oscillations. And this is, if you can follow it, this is the energy in mode 1, goes down, comes up, and here's mode 1 again. You see mode 2, mode 3, mode 4, mode 5. Without going into a lot of detail, the biggest number you see printed there is 5. So in this particular run, you had only the first 5 modes excited. Here's a run which is in more detail, but this is, in fact, this is the Fermi-Pasdeloup alpha model. The nonlinear term was even stronger here. And what you see again is, even though there's strong nonlinearity, so high, in principle, high excitation, there only the first 5 modes are excited. So more than that, only the first 5 modes being excited, you see what are called now FPU recurrences. And that is, they started in this particular case with all the energy in the lowest mode. So for their bounding conditions, a simple sine mode, where the ends of the chain were nailed down. And after 30,000 cycles here, you see that you come back to where something on the order, if you do it by energy, of 95 or 97% of the energy is back in the initial mode. This is not looking like statistical mechanics. And for those of you who are thinking about Hamiltonian dynamics and Poincaré recurrences, the Poincaré recurrence would probably be somewhere over in London on this time scale. This is a very, very short time scale, nothing to do with Poincaré recurrences. So this is the first thing they discovered. So how are we going to understand that? Well, one thing we're going to do is do even longer runs. And so a few years later, Jim Tuck and Mary Tsingu Menzel, who was an author on this paper, did a much longer study. So we were over here at 30, the first FPU recurrence. And what you saw was the FPU recurrences got worse and worse and worse, and then suddenly they got better and better and better, and they found a super recurrence where you went back to nearly 100% of the energy in the initial mode. And this is at a very long time scale. And basically, running the simulation would continue like this essentially forever. This is extremely surprising. I point out that Mary Menzel is now an author. This is doubling up. I don't know why. And so now we want to understand why this could happen. How does this happen and why? Well, I've given you the answer. The solitons explain this, but we have to understand why. We have to give a little bit of background. So discrete models are notoriously much harder to treat than the continuum, or you can use calculus instead of a complicated nonlinear algebra. And so beginning in the late 50s and 60s, several groups, Martin Kruskal played a major role in this, began to use what the applied mathematicians call multiple scale analysis, and I will come back to that, to take a formal continuum limit. So you had these masses were separated by a distance A, which was sort of the physical atomic distance when you think of this as a solid, and somehow we're going to try to go to a continuum limit where A goes to zero, the number of masses goes to infinity, so the length stays finite, and we're going to write a continuum equation. You can formally do that, and I'd like to quote some great piece of advice that I once got from Mark Katz, who was another of the famous Polish mathematicians with Ulam. He used to say, in teaching, you must tell the truth and nothing but the truth, but not the whole truth. So I won't give you the whole truth here because it's too detailed. But morally, this is what happens. You had the deviation of a mass location from its rest position was called, let's say, yn of t, so a discrete number of them. You then try to go to the continuum, or not try, you do, by taking defining a variable x equals n times a, let a go to 0 and n go to infinity, and keeping it finite. Then you look for a solution which is a co-moving wave. So it has, here's the zeta equals x minus vt, that's the wave. And then it varies on a slower time scale. Epsilon is much less than 1. So in the limit that epsilon goes to 0, this is just this is a right moving wave. And there are when you have finite epsilon, there are corrections. When you do that, and you don't tell all the truth, to get this to be a consistent solution, you found that the derivative of y with respect to this co-moving variable had to satisfy this nonlinear equation. Okay, this is, I mean, if you, many of you have cartoons on your door which have the step and then a miracle happened. I mean, this is sort of, and you can think of this as a miracle, although it's perfectly derivable. This is called the Kortevig-Defries equation after two Dutch mathematicians who discovered it in the late 19th century as a model for water waves in narrow, shallow channels. And it is pretty clearly a nonlinear equation. There's a nonlinearity. And it's also dispersive in the sense that the Fourier mode spread out in time because of this third derivative. So Zabuski and Kruskal had found this to be a consistency condition to have this kind of solution to explain FPU. And what they discovered was that this equation, the Kortevig-Defries equation, had what they call a soliton solution. So this is something you can actually check by differentiation. This function, u of x and t, which is a function of this co-moving variable, is an exact solution to that equation. But notice several things about it. First, here's the velocity that it's moving with, v. The amplitude is directly proportional to the velocity. So the faster it moves, the bigger it gets. The width is inversely proportional to the square root of the velocity. So you move a soliton quickly, it gets peaked, sharply peaked, and bigger and narrower. This is a one soliton solution. The amazing things about solitons are that, well, so here the amplitude, shape, and velocity are interdependent characteristics. This is typical for nonlinear waves. But the amazing thing is, if you take two of these with different v's, so you start the one that's moving faster behind the other one, and you shoot it through it, that the two solitons emerge and retain their identities in interactions. This is not at all obvious. This is a nonlinear equation. You cannot add solutions together and get another solution. And yet these solitons retain their identities. So here's a picture of how it works. This is an example of a soliton collision where I have the large soliton has velocity 3 and starts behind the other soliton. The other one has velocity 1.5. This is a space-time plot showing the faster soliton catching up with a slower one and then emerging through it. This is another view of the same thing. And this is probably the most impressive proof of it. This is an example of the actual collision, really solving the equation, not plotting the solution. It's an animation of the soliton collision. So you see the solitons preserve their interactions through, even though they're nonlinear, when they interact with each other. Now, how does this explain the FPU recurrences? What I'm going to tell you now is morally true, but it follows the cat's victim again of the whole truth is not there. So the initial pulse, and here I've shown you the pulse that starts in the zeroth mode, breaks up primarily into a few solitons. Okay, that's a statement that I make. I can show you why. The number and size of the solitons depends on the initial conditions. So remember that the larger pulses travel faster for KdV solitons. So here's a picture of the initial pulse after some time. I stressed only the right-moving solitons. By symmetry of the equations, you can see there also should be left-moving solitons. So this pulse breaks up into these solitons. That is, as you might have guessed, a hand-drawn, not computer-simulated model. So the solitons pass through each other. So this large soliton may have passed through these slower ones. And in this sense, because they move with different velocities, the initial pulse will obviously, if you actually Fourier analyze this pulse at this second of time where I have the snapshot, pretty clearly it has many modes in it. Okay, although, as we saw from FPU, not too many. All right. So now, because the solitons retain their identities in all their collisions, and I've asserted they retain a reflection off the walls of the system, which is essentially true, then what you can see is the soliton velocities and the length of the interval form frequencies. How long it takes the soliton, or that's a period, but 1 over how long it takes the soliton to traverse the length of the system given its velocity. So each one of these nonlinear excitations has a frequency, omega, and it's proportional to the velocity over the length. Now, in general, these frequencies will be incommensurate, related by non-rational numbers. But you can always approximate any incommensurate system by a sequence of rationals. Think of continued fractions. And so approximately, there will be a state which, for any number of solitons and any omega i's, where all the ratios will be, can be expressed rationally. There'll be a lowest common denominator for all these. That lowest common denominator gives you a time at which you would basically have all the solitons. That's morally what's going on. Now, if those of you who are following closely can immediately shoot a couple of holes in that argument, in particular, why should there be super recurrences, etc. But that is basically what's going on. And so the exactness of the approximation is a function of the number of soliton modes and the accuracy of the rational approximation. But the key element that these nonlinear excitations retain their character as they bounce through each other is what allows for the reconstruction of the initial pulse and the absence of thermalization. So that was a pretty heavy-duty argument, but now we get a little bit more mathematics, and I promise I will stop on that. So the business of the solitons and the exactness of the preservation of their interactions led to a very long story where people worked on so-called integrable models, which I will define in a minute. An integrable Hamiltonian system is one where you can write, it's basically like morally like a harmonic oscillator. You have the same number of conserved quantities as you have degrees of freedom. So that you can, and they're also in what is called involution. So for the Hamiltonian dynamics freaks, it's the Poisson brackets are all zero. What it means is, instead of having just the energy conserved, or the energy and linear momentum, they have the energy and a higher order invariant and another higher order invariant. So their phase space is completely regular, even though it's an infinite number of degrees of freedom. Non-integrable ones are the ones that don't exhibit that property and exhibit regions where they have chaotic behavior. So we're going to study two particular equations. One is called the Sine-Gordon equation. The other is called, the equations haven't come up yet. That's what the problem is. Okay. So the other is called phi-fourth. And what I'm going to show you, again, please don't differentiate while I'm lecturing. But if you chose to, you could differentiate this function for inverse tangent of that argument and find that it solves that equation. Similarly, you could differentiate this hyperbolic tangent and find that it solves that equation. So we have two different, very similar-looking partial differential equations in one spatial dimension and time, both nonlinear, and they both have these solutions that are isolated waves like the isolated waves we saw in quadratic degrees. How do we know this one is integrable and this one is not? Again, historically, it was found by experimental mathematics, where a bunch of people, including myself, collided together these solitons and saw that they did not emerge unscathed. Whereas when you collided together these solitons, they would emerge unscathed. And even better, you could write down an analytic solution which described that collision. So there's a lot of mathematics here I won't go into that now allows you to know which of these equations are integrable and which are not. But the answer is the Sine-Gordon equation is integrable, the phi-fourth equation is not. Okay. Why do I care? Well, one reason I care is that it was known that the Sine-Gordon equation possessed something which is called a breather. And you can't have forgotten already, even though it's late in the afternoon, that I mentioned discrete breathers were the same as ILMs. So now you see where we're headed. The Sine-Gordon has, in the continuum, this equation in the continuum has this analytic solution I think I highlight some stuff here. Yes. And what you notice is that this is an exactly periodic function. Don't forget about this 4 inverse tans. That doesn't really matter. It's a sine of time divided by a parameter. It is exponentially localized in space, 1 over the hyperbolic cosh. And it is a one-parameter family of solutions. And for any value of epsilon, this solution satisfies that equation. Don't worry about the analytic form here. It won't be on the quiz. What you should remember is, in the continuum, this is exactly spatially localized for all time. You can actually make it move, of course, but in its rest frame, it stays localized, and it's exactly periodic. So the question is, does this equation, the phi-fourth, which is not integrable, have a solution like the Sine-Gordon breather? Yes or no? How many people think yes? How many people think no? Okay, now I force you to vote. You have 10 seconds to decide yes or no. And then, here's a way to do it, not to embarrass anybody. Everybody close their eyes and then vote yes or no in 10 seconds. I'm serious. I really want to see it. Okay, close your eyes and vote. How many think yes? Okay, how many think no? Oh, it's equal, about equal. A lot of you didn't vote. That's not fair. But the people who voted yes were those this is a real debate, so it's not a trivial question. It took 10 years to resolve. People who voted yes are probably people who are used to numerical simulations and solve problems numerically. The people who voted no either know the answer, which is cheating, or they are the mathematical types who think that the analytic properties are important, and they're right. So indeed, I'll steal a little of my thunder. The answer is there is no phi-fourth breather, but it was a very, very non-trivial thing to find. I spent a good 8 or 9 years working on this. So why was it hard to find? Well, first thing, if you looked at the continuum phi-fourth equation, you could do what is, again, a multiple scale expansion, and you could carry this out if you really were persistent to any finite order in this parameter epsilon. Remember in the Sine-Gordon breather, there was a one-parameter family of solutions, epsilon, any value. So this is an expansion in small epsilon of a phi-fourth small amplitude breather, SAB. And you see it has, here it is, the first term, order epsilon, is periodic with period tau. There's a DC term, but that doesn't really matter. It doesn't affect the periodicity. Here's something which is still periodic, period tau, period 2 tau, order epsilon squared, also spatially localized. Here's the third order term. These C and tau are related to time and space in a complicated way, but you can carry this out to all orders, and it was localized. So this looks like exactly what you're looking for. It's an asymptotic expansion. So it's localized and periodic to all orders in epsilon. And in fact, what we tried to do was to prove that this is a small amplitude expansion. You want to try to go to a large amplitude. To do that, you had to go to the computer, and so we tried to do it numerically. There were several groups doing this at the time. So the way you do that is you take your continuum and you discretize in space, and now we're headed back to the lattice, and use the iterative method. It's basically a functional Newton's method that converges to a solution at any fixed spatial discretization, and then you study the stability of the solution. So this is the discretized form in space of the phi-fourth equation. You recognize that. This is an approximation to the second spatial derivative when you have a solution defined at spatial points separated by delta x, and phi n is the value at x equals n times delta x. So this is a coupling to the Jason springs. It can't have escaped you that this looks an awful lot like the FPU problem with a coupling to the springs. Actually, it turns out if you try to study periodic solutions, the only way to enforce it easily was to discretize in time as well. So basically, you have this humongous matrix, discretized in space, discretized in time, and so it's a big, complicated coupled map, and you went with your computer, ka-chunk, 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 and tried to converge with Newton's method to a solution. And here's what happened. This is an example. So here's your spatial discretization. You can see the points that aren't there. And what is this is a picture of the solution at various times in its period.
So this is an exactly periodic solution. We've enforced periodicity. It's localized in space. These are the values of the parameters involved. I think I highlight them now. Let's see how I do this. Yeah. So this looks like something that's localized. The fact that it has this sort of... actually, I realize now it looks like the Rolling Stones, tour. I hadn't seen that before. But the fact that it's deeper this way just simply has to do with the nature of the 5/4 potential, which is not symmetric. But this is a solution. It is stable, and it is spatially localized for delta x equals 1.2. Now, remember, the continuum is delta x equals 0. So we're pretty far from the continuum. But it's for a pretty good size value of epsilon. It's 0.4, and which is not big compared to 1, but it's a lot bigger than the epsilons where that asymptotic expansion worked. So this looks good, and all we have to do is go smaller and smaller in delta x. But we noticed already at a fairly large value of delta x, is 1.0, that there were solutions which looked like the breather in the middle, but had excitations at the edge. Okay, this goes over the whole, the system goes from minus 20 to 20 in these units, and this is not localized. All right, so this is worrying. I think Serge Aubry is responsible for this. This is called a nanopteron for wings, opter, and nano, small. So these are small wings, and they were there. It's not a localized solution. This is what we do not want to find if we want to find a 5/4 breather. So... How do we decide what happens as we go to the continuum limit? Well, these are three different plots of the solution for a fixed value of epsilon, which is happens to be near a half. This is at 1.05 equals delta x, and the solution is clearly localized. This is at 0.9, and the solution is not localized. And this is at 0.89, and the solution is also not localized. So at least in this case, it looks like as we try to go to the continuum, the solution delocalizes as x goes to 0, suggesting there is no 5/4 breather. Okay. So now, where are we? This is an awful lot of data, at almost a seminar level. I apologize, but I hope I can make the conclusion clear. Basically, the numerics could not resolve the delta x goes to 0 behavior. We just ran out of gas in terms of trying to calculate because of the size of the matrices and other numerical problems. But it did suggest that if you fixed epsilon, fixed the size of the amplitude of the oscillation, that for a finite delta x bigger than some delta x zero, which depended on epsilon, there were stable localized breathers, but it was in a discrete system. So they suggested the existence of discrete breathers. On the other hand, for x less than zero, the breathers had these extended oscillatory tails that went over the whole system, so they became these so-called nanopterons. That's all the numerics could do. The regions of stability, as you went to delta x equals zero, were very complicated. I think I'm going to skip through this, believe it or not, because I think I just don't want to take the time on it. The point there was that we could understand our numerical results in terms of the coupling of the nonlinear oscillation to linear modes with frequency twice the frequency of the nonlinear oscillation, which is the first allowed coupling. That is an important conclusion. So, but here's what was finally resolved here. Again, Martin Kruskal played a major role working with Harvey Seeger. They showed that this small amplitude expansion is asymptotic in the strict mathematical sense, and that terms beyond all orders gave you a form, i.e. of the form 1 over e to the minus 1 over epsilon, made the breather decay into the spatially extended linear excitations, which in the solid-state context are phonons, and that led to a nanopteron. So the leading term is the second harmonic of the breather, consistent with the numerics. So here you have the actual solution in the 5/4 theory is that small amplitude breather, which I wrote down, all those powers of epsilon, localized. But then there's an e to the minus 1 over epsilon times an extended a small oscillation, and plus higher order terms. So this is there is no stable breather in the continuum limit in 5/4. By the way, I had a nice talk with Sabina Stanley about similar kinds of
e to the minus 1 over of x in the cases of viscosities, where you have singular terms as the viscosity goes to zero. These are very well-known phenomena. Michael Berry has made a career out of understanding how those work. So it wasn't really as much of a surprise as it was then. So that's beyond all orders in epsilon. And now it's rigorously known that those of you who voted no are absolutely right. The Sine-Gordon equation requires a true soliton equation to have the stabilized breather or any higher order nonlinear excitations. And the reason is basically those excitations are in one-to-one correspondence with the higher order conserved quantities. If you don't have them, you don't have higher order solutions.
Sorry.
Yeah?
When you say unstable, though, you don't mean in a temporal sense, some kind of structural sense, because you can't even find a solution, let alone an unstable one.
Well, okay. What I would mean is if I took what was putatively a solution and ran it in time, it would literally, its energy would leak out. Whereas if I took the Sine-Gordon breather as a putative solution and ran it in time, it would stay localized. So that's what I mean. It's a slightly different experiment, but you're right. The only solution you'll converge to is the one that's extended. Yeah. Okay, so now we're finally back to intrinsic localized modes, discrete breathers, and I'm going to try to give you the intuition as to why this works. So let's consider the simplest model of an extended system, namely two systems, a diatomic molecule, and we'll view it as two coupled anharmonic oscillators. Nonlinearity is essential in this. And I remind you that what I mean by anharmonic is that the restoring force for the oscillators is not linear. It has at least a quadratic term in it. And what that means is that the frequency of the motion depends on the amplitude. And if you think, I mean, that sounds... I haven't thought about that for a while. It's because we abuse our physics students by telling them that the frequency of the pendulum is independent of its amplitude, which is absolutely not true. If you get to large motions, and then the period it takes forever to go around, the frequency goes to zero if you go to an inverted pendulum, right? In principle, classically, it takes an infinite time to come around. So the frequency of a pendulum actually decreases with amplitude for large amplitudes. It's only approximate. I mean, strictly speaking, only in the approximation that you say the sine of theta, the restoring angle, equals theta, do you get a linear equation and a frequency that's independent of the amplitude. So that's what I mean. The frequency, changing the amplitude a little bit changes the frequency. Now consider the anticontinuum limit. Now I've defined this. These are that we have two of these atoms, two of these oscillators, they're not coupled at all. They're completely independent. Well, then it's trivial to localize the energy on one of the oscillators. You just excite it, and it's not coupled to the other one, so it's sitting there. All right. And since the frequency of oscillation depends on the amplitude, the higher the energy, depending on the nature of the nonlinearity, the different the frequency. Now consider weak coupling. So we just barely couple these oscillators. Let's suppose one oscillator is very highly excited and the other one is not excited, or just a little bit. In fact, the frequencies are very different. Therefore, the frequencies are very different. And let's suppose that they are not commensurate or approximately not commensurate. Then there are no possible resonances between the oscillators, and the energy transfer must be very difficult, if possible at all. So this is a very sloppy kind of argument, but you can actually make a physical system consisting of two coupled pendulum. I don't know how many of you know Bob Austin, the biological physicist at Princeton. He actually got so interested in this, he made one. And you can make two coupled pendula weakly torsionally coupled, and you can start one off in large oscillations, and the other one will stay absolutely still until the first one gets down into smaller oscillation mode, and then they start coupling. So this coupling argument is actually better than it would seem. And in fact, you can formalize it via the Kolmogorov-Arnold-Moser theorem, which is an important theorem in nonlinear dynamics. So the intuition is you start off with oscillators where the frequency depends on the amplitude, and if you get into a regime where one oscillator is highly nonlinearly excited, it does not couple well at all to the other oscillator. Now let's take our favorite Phi-4th model. You've seen this before. Now we have a chain of oscillators, as many as we want, N of them. This is sometimes called a doubled well oscillator because I didn't stress the signs here, but the actual minimum of the potential corresponding to this force is at phi n equals 1. I didn't stress it because I didn't want to get tied up on it, but you remember in my small amplitude breather expansion, the first term was 1? That's this. So it's a double well oscillator. Now you can see these oscillators, if I put delta x equal to 0, I have a simple nonlinear oscillator at psi n and no coupling. So delta x determines the coupling. In fact, 1 over delta x squared tells you how strong the coupling is. As delta x goes to infinity, the coupling goes to 0. And as we go to the, this is chosen with great malice aforethought, the continuum limit is delta x equals 0, and then the coupling is infinitely strong. So, now this is a part I should, for those of you who've had solid state physics, or any periodic structure, this is trivial. For those of you who haven't, I've got to be careful, so let me take some time with this. you take the spectrum of linear small oscillations around the minimum. So we're looking at the harmonic oscillations around the minimum. That spectrum is given by the dispersion relation, where the frequency of those oscillations is related to the momentum of the oscillations, so a dispersion relation, by this analytic form. That's a simple matter to solve that equation. And what you see are two things. One, because of the nature of this potential, there is a finite value for the intercept of the frequency. At zero momentum, the frequency is the square root of 2. So basically, this is an optical phonon. But the sine function here, sine squared, is restricted to be 1. And so the minimum energy excitation is 2. The maximum is 2 plus 4 over delta x squared, which was this is 1. Now, that's a band. That's a finite range in frequency space. It's bounded from above and from below. And the upper cutoff, oops, I went blue right by. The key point is there's an upper cutoff on the spectrum that's due to discreteness. Okay? So all this sounds very simple, but now, for the nonlinear oscillations, now we're going away from the linear oscillations, the frequencies decrease with amplitude, just as in a simple pendulum. And so we can make a localized nonlinear mode. It's nonlinear because we have to take advantage of the change in frequency with amplitude, so it has to be nonlinear. With a frequency, which I call with great malice aforethought omega b, which lies below the continuum. So we have below the band. Here's the band. I crank up the nonlinearity. I've told you the frequency decreases with amplitude. That's a fact. So I pull a state out of that band and it lies below it. Okay? If delta x is big enough, then this band is very, very narrow. And I can always choose just the right amount of nonlinearity so that omega b is just below the band. And twice omega b is above the band. So there is no linear coupling of this local mode to the extended states. There's no way that it can decay. It can't couple to the phonons. So this, the fact that you have nonlinearity means that you can get a frequency outside the band. The fact that you have a discrete system means there's a band, and so you have no coupling to the extended modes. This is not just talk. These are actual simulations. It's a complicated figure, so I'll take some time on this one, too. So here is that 2 plus 2 over delta x squared sine squared q over 2, the dispersion relation. This is actually a plot of omega equals q, and all this shows you is the width of the band. Okay? And this is actually for delta x equals 10, so you can even check it. This is 1.4, obviously sort of 1.4, that's square root of 2, and this is 1.4. This is a 1.4, well, sorry. It's whatever the square root of 2 plus 4 over 10 squared is. So this is 1.6. Fairly narrow region. What you see here is these are actual solutions to the Phi-4th equation. Let's start with the ones down here. There's a mode that has frequency omega b equals
this number, which is about 1.28. So 2 omega B is 2.56. It's up here. And there's not just one of them. There's a mode that has a single state, a single particle in the chain excited, and there's a mode that has two adjacent particles excited. Now, I skipped over this when I talked before, but what you can see is this is an on-site, on the lattice site discrete breather, and this is effectively centered between the lattice sites because the two adjacent lattice sites have the same amplitude, so the peak is between them. Notice that these have, this character of these states is that the adjacent particles are moving in the same direction. So this is like an acoustic mode. So below the band, you have acoustic-type ILMs. If you go do the same analysis above the band, you find there's an... I didn't give you the intuition for it, but it is true that there's a localized mode, a breather here, frequency about 1.66, with optical characteristics, adjacent particles moving out of phase, both on-site and in-between. There are actually a huge number of these. As you change omega B, you can have both kinds for a wide range of parameters, essentially like the Sine-Gordon equation, where you had a one-parameter family of solutions. So these are actual stable numerical solutions. You can calculate them on a computer. You can verify their linear stability. And they're allowed to exist and be stable because the nonlinearity means their frequency can move out of the linear band, and the discreteness means that their harmonics don't couple. So you can make the anti-continuum arguments I gave you rigorous, and you can describe the very important thing is you can construct these intrinsic localized modes in any number of spatial dimensions. Nothing depends on the number of spatial dimensions. No magic of 1D as in solitons. It doesn't look easy, but you can actually make them propagate, and they can be generated by thermal fluctuations. So when you heat a system locally, highly nonlinearly, you can make one of these intrinsic localized modes. And in fact, in principle, people are arguing these are maybe localized mechanisms for melting. They can also be quantized. I don't want to go into that. Not surprisingly, they are very strong and highly frequency-dependent scatterers of linear modes, so they would show up in certain experiments very dramatically. This is basically the end of the division. Now I want to tell you a little bit about historical precursors, and then I'll go into the experiments. Well, first, continuum breathers and non-integrable theories. I spent 20 minutes on that. Hopefully you haven't forgotten it already. They aren't there except in Sine-Gordon, and the search for them led directly to a discovery of discrete breathers in discrete systems. This is a little more, this is very interesting, a little more subtle. Bloch's theorem implies that in extended band states are the only states that can exist in perfectly periodic solids. But it was known to Landau when he first recognized the existence of a polaron that if the lattice can be distended, you therefore break the perfect symmetry and the theorem is valid. And this is modeled by, was modeled in the 50s by Ted Holstein by a discrete nonlinear Schrodinger equation. This is, you can see here is the wave function at the nth site. Here's a coupling to the neighboring sites. Here's a nonlinearity, and this looks like a Schrodinger equation, except that psi n squared replaces the energy, so it has the name discrete nonlinear Schrodinger equation. The similarity of this to the phi fourth can't have escaped you, and this system has a exact localized soliton solution, which is, by our terms, a discrete breather, but it's essentially it's a trivial example of a discrete breather because it can occur for any frequency. You can see that just by taking e to the I omega t, because that's the mod psi squared, the time dependence cancels out and it's linear. But this is another example. This was recognized and followed up as an example, a precursor. A more important precursor intellectually, although it wasn't recognized as such until afterwards, and this is due to the chemists, they realized that because the vibrational potential in molecules was typically anharmonic, you could have localized vibrational excitations, things that were not spread out over the molecule. They studied it in particular in benzene, and the way it shows up in the quantum systems is that these localized modes
are moved down in energy. They're redshifted from the values expected based on just multiples of the phonon frequency. So these quantum ILMs were predicted and observed in benzene. They're not infinitely stable, but they're long-lived. And there was some confusion about this in the chemical literature that was only cleared up in the last few years. So let me try to finish in the next couple minutes by telling you what the experiments are. Starting at the lowest energy and lowest length scale, this is an example of a charge transfer solid, or MX chain, it's sometimes called, it's platinum chloride chain, where you have the large atoms are platinum, the small ones are chlorine. And what happens, you shoot in a photon, you excite one of the electrons from the platinum, one platinum to the adjacent platinum. Notice that this system is, if you will, dimerized. This is now the unit cell. The chlorines are closer to this one, this platinum than that one. When you excite the electron over here to the adjacent platinum, you attract the chlorine atom, and then when it jumps back and escapes with different energies, so there's some energy in this mode, you have this vibration going back and forth. And in fact, in principle, you think this vibration could be extended, would extend over the system. It, for certain parameters, it doesn't. It stays as an intrinsic localized vibrational mode that is observable in the redshift of the Raman modes. This is pretty inferential. It's not direct measurement. You're not sitting here watching this chlorine wiggle, but it's consistent with the theory. The Josephson junction experiments are much more visual and very... by the way, all the references are in the paper that I have here. This picture shows you an annular Josephson junction ladder. What do I mean by that? If you can see the green, it's two rings connected by radial spokes. Every green line on there is a Josephson junction. And you can make excitations if you run current through it. When you get a normal state, you see the resistive drop, and that's when you see the red dots. So this is an extended solution where all the annular, all the radial parts of the ladder are normal. Here is a state where you have a localized mode that is where the normal state is confined to this area. Here's one down here. These are the pictures. These are the actual experimental data. The way it's observed is using, I won't go into detail. Actually, John could tell us much better than I can. But using scanning tunneling microscopes. But this is a localized, here's a spatially extended state, here's a localized mode in a Josephson junction. Optical waveguides are another example. Here you make an artificial semiconductor periodic structure, and you input a focused laser beam across the structure. You look at, here's the input, and there's the output. And you're looking at this end, okay, what I'm going to show you. So the dimensions of the system, this is on scale of microns. So basically you see a periodic, spatially generated periodic structure caused by the semiconductor. Here's what happens at the out. Now you're looking at the end of the laser. I won't try this at home. You're looking directly into the laser as it comes out of the semiconductor structure at various different energies. This is pretty not so clear, perhaps. This is 20 milliwatts, 100 milliwatts, and 200 milliwatts. At low energy, the mode is effectively linear and spreads out across the entire periodic structure as you'd expect from a linear oscillation. As you increase the power, the the output starts to focus down. It does not spread out. It does not diffract, as they use in optics. It does not disperse the way you would expect. And at very high power, it essentially remains localized in the single on the single site in the lattice where you input it. And the reason is that it cannot diffract out because it for the same arguments we made before, its frequency is outside the band that is allowed by the periodicity. This is another example. This is another experiment, Martin et al., where it's a really clever experiment where they have a crystal. They change its optical properties by putting in a laser beam that forms a lattice for the lasers in the system. So using photorefractive properties of the crystal. You then send in a probe beam, and this is as you go up in energy, this is the input, so it's localized at a single site. You then look at low energy this is the input. This is in the absence of a photonic lattice. It just goes across. This is a linear diffraction that occurs in the system. This is what happens when you have a weak lattice created by the first laser. You see it also spreads out. And when you have a strong nonlinearity, you see that the input, localized input, remains localized at the output. So without going into too much detail, because this is an effectively two-dimensional intrinsic localized mode. So what's going to happen in the future? I'm not going to go into the details of these things because I've taken more of your time than I should have, perhaps. But you can imagine making artificial two types of semiconductors, semiconductor rods. You can easily make a localized mode there. Localized modes are thought to play, conceivably playing a role in the unzipping of DNA. This is a model of a chain beta polymer where you start an excitation here, it migrates to the middle of the chain, it stays localized and leads to the folding. It's conceivable that is so you would excite, for instance, by an STM tip and then watch the thing fold. So basically, in summary, we've seen that the intrinsic localized modes are more robust and ubiquitous than the solitons because they can appear in any number of dimensions, and we expect them in a wider range of physical systems. It's conceivable that they may play roles in advanced photon switching devices, energy transport, storage, and effective energy storage and localization processes in biopolymers, in fact, in melting and in the unzipping of DNA and the folding of protons, folding of proteins. The important point to recognize is after a long sort of period where the theory was the head of experiment in the sense of being possibly not even real, a lot of recent results have confirmed that these things are... I didn't show you results in of Al Sievers at all in quasi-one-dimensional antiferromagnetic materials. There are very exciting results there where you can see individual intrinsic localized modes being created and destroyed. They've been seen in ultra-cold atoms. There's actually some recent very nice work on localized intrinsic localized modes in Fermi-Pass-Ulam itself. And you can there have been proposals to observe these modes in macromolecules by exciting them with an STM tip. So there's a lot of interest in trying to make these localized intrinsic localized modes in a wide variety of systems. So I've already summarized and concluded. I don't know why I had this second slide. Basically, to summarize the overall talk, the odyssey from the Fermi-Pass-Ulam problem to intrinsic localized modes followed a very remarkable course, even more remarkable than I've indicated. I will answer a question about that at the end. So we were led from the FPU recurrences to the Korteweg de Vries solitons. We studied the problem of whether these soliton-like solutions were generic in the sense that the breathers that existed in Sine-Gordon existed also in Phi-4th. The numerics showed that there might be no breathers in the continuum, but there might be in the discrete. And then the anti-continuum limit led to the discovery of the highly localized intrinsic localized modes in discrete breathers. These things are all over the place, and we've seen them in experiments. Let me just leave that up for a second. But there's a nice epilogue on the Fermi-Pass-Ulam problem. Fermi-Pass-Ulam, which celebrated its 50th anniversary last year, did not lead only to solitons and to explanations of the recurrence, but also actually led to the rediscovery of chaos. It spurred the interest in Hamiltonian chaos. It's still giving deep insights into the nature of statistical mechanics, anomalous thermal and energy transport in low dimensions, and this whole issue of energy localization. Fermi once remarked it was a remarkable, quite a little discovery, and he really understated it. It was the birth of both nonlinear science and computational science, and it was a very important discovery. Thank you very much. Right.
About 100 pound solutions, but the FPU system is not really integral.
That's correct. No, you do not have integrability strictly in FPU. It's an asymptotic solution, so what it means is that after some time it will break down. So there will be a time when your continuum solution becomes a bad approximation to the lattice. That's right, but as you say, they're few and far between, and they are not necessarily they're certainly not in simple correspondence to the solution you get of KdV. And what Zabuski showed is that the behavior of FPU for a long time was pretty well modeled by KdV. But it breaks down. Actually, a better example is the total lattice. Okay, the total lattice is a discrete system which is completely integrable. And you can follow these soliton-like excitations in FPU and TOTA in time. And what you see is they look very similar for a very long time, and then they start diverging. And if you look at the maximum Lyapunov exponent, Eddie Cohen has done this, you'll see that for the total lattice, it goes... You know, it goes down, goes below zero or one, depending how you define the exponent. For the for FPU, it stays above one. So it there is chaos in FPU, there isn't in total.
You describe systems in which you have nonlinear oscillators, mm-hmm. which are coupled to a nearest stable interaction.
Right.
In many systems, there are long range. Mm-hmm. And they may in fact compete sometimes with the nearest neighbor's attractive.
Right.
Either attractive and repulsive competing or non competing, how much of what you have said would be preserved in such nonlinear systems?
It would certainly depend on the strength and nature of the longer range interactions. But I'm trying to remember a specific paper where they studied that. I can't think of one on the spot.
It would be strong enough.
It would have to be strong enough to fundamentally destroy these basic arguments about coupling. I don't know of a proof of the existence of the discrete breathers for long-range interactions.
Because you brought up biological systems, protein folding and unzipping, in those systems,
I mean, there's certainly the existence of local-like excitations in long-range biological models has been molecules has been argued for a long time, but I can't think of a Mackay and Obrey have a rigorous proof for Hamiltonian systems with short-range interactions. I don't know about it for long-range. I have to think of that. I don't. It would not destroy it for modest size of the interaction. I'm confident of that. Yeah, I mean the solitons are, as you correctly said, found only in very special equations, which have this characteristic of being completely integrable. I mean, when I say solitons, I mean the ones that have families of solutions corresponding to multiple humps, multiple soliton solutions. The thing about the intrinsic localized modes module, this long range interaction, basically they will exist in any nonlinear system that is discrete in any spatial dimension for sufficient nonlinearity. So they're much. That's why they're much more ubiquitous than the solitons are. Solitons are a special thing.
How does Maniac 1, who's hundreds of calculations compared to your laptops?
MANIAC 1 is less than the computer that powers your digital watch. Yeah, more or less.
Related to that, I remember this original FPU problem. They're actually trying to study energy transfer.
They didn't.
There's a
focus issue of chaos that came out in January of last year, volume 15, number one, on the anniversary, March, on FPU, where a lot of these questions are answered. And so transport is an out-of-equilibrium phenomenon, and there's some very weird things that happen in quasi-one-dimensional systems in transport. It's anomalous. It's not the Debye theory or the Fourier heat theorem. And there's a lot of studies of that. They're answered there. You guys didn't ask me the one question, but FPU wanted to study equal partition. So it turns out that the same Eddie Cohen I just mentioned and his Italian collaborators, I think, have pretty well answered the following question. Will the FPU system go to thermal equilibrium under any circumstances? And the answer is yes. If FPU had put in 10 times more energy in their initial runs, the system would have shown equilibration, and the soliton wouldn't have been discovered, at least not that way. So it's a bit of good fortune. You always have to keep your eye. Nigel was talking about something, a discovery that he made where it looked like mashed potatoes, but he looked more carefully at it. You know, but it was right in front of him. But what Cohen and company have shown is, for any finite system, there is an energy per particle threshold such that below that threshold you have this seemingly integrable behavior essentially for all times. If you go above that threshold, you do get equal partition. So how does this jibe with statistical mechanics? Well, that threshold goes to zero as n goes to infinity. So it's actually a fairly simple explanation in the end. Oh, that's actually not proved yet. That's what people think.